The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary S. Katzmann presiding before Court Number 18-00225, Coalition of American Flange Producers versus the United States. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
Hello, good morning. This is Stephanie Bell with Wiley Ryan on behalf of plaintiff, the Coalition of American Flange Producers.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Daniel Pickard, also of Wiley Ryan on behalf of the plaintiff.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Jeffrey Long of the United States Department of Justice for the United States in this matter.
This is Karen Huff with the U.S. Department of Commerce.
Thank you, counsel. This is Judge Katzmann, and I want to express my appreciation to you for coming together this morning. This teleconference format. The pandemic, of course, has affected all of us, and our hopes are with all of those who are suffering so badly. We are hoping to, in terms of our court work, to push forward, and we express our thanks to you for your cooperation in that regard. This morning's argument is also going to be recorded, and there will be a posting on the website within the hour after completion of the argument of the recording. The as you know, this session is really designed to permit counsel to engage with the answers that have been submitted to questions. The court on March 25th sent out questions in advance of oral argument. Those are detailed questions to both sides, questions which presented the issues that were of particular concern to the court. And counsel submitted earlier this week detailed answers. The plaintiff submitted a 27-page filing. The government and defendant submitted a 19-page filing. So what would be particularly helpful would be for you to use this argument as an opportunity to engage with the answers that have been submitted by opposing counsel. You have the opportunity, if you wish, to make a brief opening statement, but that's up to you. Let me assure the parties that I approach this case with an open mind. It's a case involving the Department of Commerce's calculation of normal value in determining appropriate anti-dumping margins for the importation of stainless steel flanges from India into the United States. It's a case which raises very interesting issues of administrative law, substantial evidence, and related questions. So without further ado, why don't we begin with the plaintiff? And I think it's Ms. Bell will be arguing, if I'm correct.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. Again, for the record, this is Stephanie Bell with Wiley Ryan on behalf of plaintiff, Coalition of American Flange Producers. And I'm going to take up the court on its offer to present a very brief opening statement before turning directly to our response to the defendant's answer to the court's question. The question before the court today is fairly straightforward. With Commerce's decision that Chandon's home market was not viable, supported by substantial evidence, and otherwise in accordance with law, a plain reading of Commerce's final determination demonstrates that the answer is no. Despite numerous submissions on this issue over the course of about 8 months, Commerce's determination was essentially limited to the following, and this is on page 37 of the issue and decision memorandum. Quote, here, we found that Chandon's aggregate volume of sales of foreign-like products in the home market was less than 5% of the company's sales of subject merchandise to the United States. Specifically, we find that the sales contract contains the packing terms that Chandon agreed to with the buyer, which shows an agreement to make the packing of excellent quality. Thus, Chandon provided documentary evidence demonstrating that it knew at the time of the sale that the ultimate destination was outside of India. Specifically, the sales contract stated that the syringes were to be marked with an affiliate's logo that was outside of India. Therefore, in accordance with Section 773A1C of the Act, we find that Chandon's home market sales are not viable. The petitioner's arguments that Chandon's home market is viable and therefore normal value should be based on home market sales prices is unsubstantiated. End quote. Of these six sentences, four state the agency's conclusion, and the remaining two sentences simply point to facts on the record that Commerce found in support of its determination without any analysis or any discussion of detracting evidence. Such an abbreviated conclusory determination does not rise to the level of supported by substantial evidence and otherwise enforced the law. While we've identified a number of faults in Commerce's determination, I think the problem is best highlighted by its failure to address information that undermines its reliance on the export packing and logo requirements, which again are the only two facts in support of its determination that Commerce identifies. Now, the specifics get into BPI, so I'm not going to explicitly discuss them here, and we have walked through them in our submissions before the court, but the record evidence shows that neither of these facts would demonstrate the sales were for export. Yet Commerce failed to address this evidence in any manner in its final determination. Having failed to do so, Commerce's determination is not supported by substantial evidence or in accordance with law. As such, we respectfully request that the court remand this determination. Now, turning to the court's specific questions, the first one presented to defendants was, what was the rational connection between the record evidence and Commerce's conclusion? In responding to this question, defendants' response suffers from the same inadequacy as Commerce's determination. Defendants simply point to the two facts relied upon by Commerce, that the sales contract included a requirement for export quality packing and that the franchise would carry the logo of a non-Indian company. However, both defendants' response and Commerce's determination fail to grapple with evidence that directly undermines the agency's reliance on both of these factors. As we've described in detail in our submissions, evidence on the record directly contradicts the conclusion that either of these factors, either alone or in combination, would necessarily demonstrate that the sales are for export. Commerce cannot be said to have provided a rational connection between the record evidence and its conclusions, or has failed to address contradictory information in any manner or explain how its conclusions are supported in light of this information. Next, the court similarly asks what standards Commerce must meet and whether it was met here. In arguing that Commerce has met its obligation to provide a reasoned explanation, defendant again points to the two facts relied on and states the totality of the circumstances constitutes substantial evidence. Again, as with Commerce's determination, conclusory statements do not equate to a reasoned analysis. This is particularly true given that the record contains evidence that undermines Commerce's conclusion, which the agency did not address in any manner. Additionally, the court has repeatedly explained that the agency is required to address material issues and to take into account evidence that detracts from its determination. Commerce did not do so here. Again, as I said, there's information directly undermining Commerce's reliance on both of these factors, and there's nothing in Commerce's determination that provides any indication of how the agency considered this evidence or how it came to a conclusion in spite of this evidence. Thus, in light of the record as a whole, Commerce has not provided a reasoned explanation for its determination. Next, the court asks about Commerce's obligations to address ambiguous information. So in responding, defendants correct that Commerce is not required to explicitly address every piece of record evidence. However, the agency is required to address material issues and to take into account information that detracts from its conclusion. Commerce did not do this here, as there's no discussion or analysis of record evidence that undermines its conclusion. While the defendant points to the fact that the agency is presumed to have considered all record evidence, this court has explained that agencies cannot rely on this obligation as, quote, a talismanic justification for the total absence of any specific discussion. This is exactly the defendant's thesis here. Additionally, defendants claim that the presence of ambiguity does not preclude the finding of substantial evidence is unpersuasive. First, the evidence relied on by Commerce does not support its conclusion because it's not probative of whether the merchandise was for sale in the home market or for export. Thus, the record is not ambiguous as it cannot support two different conclusions. Second, even if the record could be considered ambiguous, Commerce's failure to grapple with the detracting evidence and explain why this information does not undermine its conclusion still amounts to a failure by the agency to address material information and provide a reasoned analysis. Moving on to question two, this relates to Commerce's obligation to address all evidence on the record. So in responding, the defendant again points to the Commerce's obligation to consider all record evidence. This does not insulate Commerce's determination from error. The question before the agency is whether Chandon knew or should have known the sale to issue were for export. In other words, Chandon's knowledge is the central issue here. Thus, what Chandon said about its knowledge is relevant to Commerce's determination. And not to belabor this point too much, but I think it's informative to look at what Chandon actually said for itself. For example, in its December 8th submission, and this is PR Doc 119, on page 5, Chandon addresses our argument about its knowledge, specifically our argument that Chandon had not demonstrated it had knowledge of these symbols for export, and it states, quote, Chandon wishes to emphasize that the submission made to the department dated October 18, 2017, contains all relevant facts and evidence establishing the quantum of home market sales for consumption in India, end quote. So again, Chandon is making, is presenting what it is saying constitutes all the relevant information, and it made this argument again and again for approximately 8 months between October, when it first made the submission, and prior to submitting its rebuttal brief. And given that this is the central issue, what was Chandon's knowledge, it behooved the department to address this and how this played into its consideration. This is particularly highlighted by the fact that Commerce did not find persuasive any of the evidence that Chandon repeatedly identified as all the relevant facts and information regarding its knowledge. In addition, contrary to what the defendant suggests, we are not arguing that Commerce is required to draw a negative inference or that this information should have been ignored. Instead, because the information goes directly to Chandon's knowledge, Commerce was required to address it in some manner, which they did not do. To the next question, question three, whether Commerce should draw negative inferences from the respondent's delaying submitting new information. In responding, the defendant appears to misunderstand our argument regarding the timing of Chandon's claim. Plaintiff is not arguing that such evidence should be ignored, and we're also not arguing that adverse facts available should have been implied. Instead, given the nature of the issue before the agency, the timing of Chandon's argument is relevant. Specifically, given that Chandon was the party that was requesting Commerce depart from its normal methodology of using home market sales, and Chandon was asserting that it knew these sales were export, it's reasonable to assume that it would, in fact, identify all relevant information at the outset, or, at the very least, once plaintiffs have challenged its position. And in fact, as defendants state, the export packaging and logo information was in the documentation that Chandon provided in its initial submission in October. Yet, Chandon never highlighted this information until 8 months later in its rebuttal brief. This begs the question of why. If Chandon is requesting that Commerce allow it to modify its reporting, why would it not identify the information and the information which, according to Commerce, is the only information that actually demonstrated this knowledge until so far late in the proceeding? The fact that Chandon did not identify this information earlier, despite numerous submissions on the issue, detracts from the conclusion that this information did in fact provide Chandon with knowledge. This is further confirmed by other information that plaintiffs highlighted, demonstrating that these facts do not support a finding that Chandon knew the sales were export. Next, with respect to the department viewing information holistically and whether this was a post hoc rationalization, plaintiff continues to believe that defendant's argument that the packing requirement in combination with the local requirement demonstrated knowledge, that this is a post hoc rationalization. Moreover, relying on the fact that Commerce is required to consider the record as a whole does not substitute for the agency providing an explanation for its determination. Nonetheless, even if this was the basis for Commerce's determination, the agency still failed to address the evidence on the record that contradicts the conclusion that either of these facts, whether considered together or individually, support a finding that Chandon knew the sales were for export. So in essence, whether the court were to find that this is a post hoc rationalization or not doesn't affect the ultimate question, which is whether Commerce's determination was supported by substantial evidence. Moving to question five, which is regarding which issues were material and why. Contrary to the defendant's claim, Commerce did not address all material issues in its termination. The central issue before Commerce is whether Chandon knew or had reason to know that certain sales were for export. Evidence that directly undermines the conclusion is thus material to the agency's determination. Yet Commerce's final determination provides no indication that the agency considered this information or why it made its findings in light of this evidence. Defendant's response to this question does not demonstrate otherwise. First, defendant does not address the evidence that directly undermines Commerce's reliance on the export packing and removal marking to support its conclusion. Second, with respect to the other factors that are discussed, such as the initial quote, the meal test certificates, and the financial statement, defendant misunderstands the argument. The issue is that Chandon presented this as the totality of the information demonstrating its knowledge. However, as Commerce apparently agreed, this information does not do so. This raises the question regarding the reliability of Chandon's statements concerning its knowledge. That Commerce did not address this constitutes a material issue that the agency failed to discuss. Questions 6 and 6A get to Commerce's obligation to conduct a diligent inquiry and whether they should have done so here. In its defense, defendant states that had plaintiff placed information on the record indicating that Chandon did not have knowledge, then the agency would have had to evaluate it and potentially seek more information. However, this was exactly what plaintiff did. During the investigation, Chandon identified the factors that it considered relevant, and plaintiff explained in their submission how none of these factors demonstrated Chandon's knowledge. Yet, Commerce took no steps to further investigate. Now, notably, Commerce apparently agreed with plaintiff, as it did not rely on any of the evidence provided by Chandon prior to its rebuttal briefing for the final determination. In other words, Commerce appeared to implicitly agree that before the submission of Chandon's rebuttal brief, information on the record called into question Chandon's assertions regarding its knowledge, yet Commerce took no steps to further investigate Chandon's claims. Thus, the agency failed to undertake a diligent inquiry as required. Question 7 gets to whether Commerce was under a duty to request information from plaintiff or from MFC directly regarding this issue. And as defendant stated, Commerce was under no obligation to request this information. However, plaintiff should not be faulted for failing to place information on the record refuting Chandon's claims, as defendant suggests. As the question is one of Chandon's knowledge, Chandon is the party here that has the relevant information, not plaintiff or MFC or any other third party. Next, with respect to the balance between the burden of an interested party to create an adequate record and Commerce's duty to diligently inquire, as discussed, because plaintiff raised arguments that called into question Chandon's assertions regarding his knowledge, Commerce was obligated to undertake a diligent inquiry, which it did not do. That plaintiff did not provide any new factual information in this regard does not change the analysis. Not only did plaintiff identify information calling into question Chandon's knowledge, again, a fact that Commerce apparently agreed with, but as the relevant question is what Chandon knew, neither plaintiff nor other third parties were the parties with the relevant information here. Moving to question 9, whether Commerce was aware of why Chandon classified the sales it receives as third country market sales. In responding to the question, defendant points to Chandon's statement that it does not have details of the ultimate destination of the sale. However, this misunderstands the relevance of Chandon's statements regarding the logo requirements. There's no information on the record that the presence of a logo means the merchandise cannot be sold in India. Moreover, to accept Chandon's claims about why it is not near the destination of these goods undermines the conclusion that the logo is indicative of its knowledge. Now, the specifics get into DPI information, so I'm not going to repeat them here, and they are laid out on pages 3 and 4 of our response to the court's questions. But in short, Chandon's own statements about its knowledge of where the goods were sold undermines the conclusion that the logo requirement demonstrated that Chandon knew the sample for export. In its response, defendant also references information that predates the PUI, but this is unpersuasive. Aside from the fact that this information says nothing about the period at issue, and there's nothing to suggest that Chandon was aware of this information at the time it made the sale, Commerce made no reference whatsoever to this information in the final determination, and thus it cannot be used to prop up the determination here. Next, the court similarly asks whether the logo provision in the sales agreement, why Commerce inferred that the logo indicated it would be for export to a non-Indian market. Neither Commerce nor defendant have provided any reason why it's reasonable for the agency to conclude that the logo indicated that the merchandise was for export in light of other record information, including Chandon's own statements. In other words, it's not reasonable to both accept Chandon's statement that the merchandise should not be treated as sales to a particular market and at the same time conclude that the logo indicates that the sales are for export. The fact that the sales documentation also included an export packing requirement does not remedy this given record information about the export packing requirement. Again, this all gets into BPI information, so I will not repeat it here, and I would just direct the court to pages 2 through 4 of our response to the court's questions, as well as pages 12 through 14 of our opening brief. And it goes through the facts in more detail. And to the extent that Commerce still considers this information probative in light of the contradictory evidence on the record, it was required to provide some explanation or analysis that would have allowed the parties in the court to understand its rationale in light of the record as a whole. Next, question 10 gets to this issue of the Indian law requiring that buyers inform sellers that merchandise is being purchased for export. Defendant's response to this question actually highlights the error in Commerce's determination. The defendant lays out why this information doesn't detract from Commerce's determination. However, the problem is this is nowhere to be found in Commerce's decision. To the extent that defendant's explanation constitutes Commerce's position, the agency provided no such explanation or any indication of this explanation in its final determination, and that's the problem with Commerce's decision. Instead of explaining why it came to this conclusion in light of the evidence and argument on the record, Commerce's final determination essentially ignores everything on the record beyond the two specific facts that it stated to support its conclusion. And lastly, the court asked about the fact that Chandon was more or less not represented by counsel during the course of proceeding. And as defendants stated, parties may represent themselves, and there's no different requirement for parties that are pro se versus pro se counsel. However, the fact that Chandon was making these submissions apparently unrepresented provides some context to what's going on here. So Chandon is apparently sophisticated enough to identify this very specific, very technical provision of the dumping law that essentially allows it to significantly modify what information it's reporting to the document. So it's sophisticated enough to sort of identify this and apply it to its situation and present it to the department at the very beginning of the investigation, yet it's apparently not sophisticated enough to actually identify all the relevant information at the outset of the proceeding. And those two things just sort of contradict each other a little bit. So this just goes to the fact that Chandon didn't identify the export packing and local requirements as relevant until its rebuttal brief and detracts from the reliability of its reliance on these factors. But nonetheless, the ultimate question is whether Commerce's determination was supported, and given that it entirely failed to address information that directly undermines its conclusion, it cannot be said that it was, regardless of whether Chandon was represented or not and what implications that might have. So I'd be happy to answer any questions from the court, but that was all I had planned on presenting at this time.
No, thank you very much, Ms. Bell. I think that you've made a very fine presentation and engaged the answers submitted by the defendant. That is much appreciated. So,
thank you, Your Honor.
The court does not have any further questions at this time. Mr. Long, for the government, are you prepared to begin your presentation?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. So I intend, Your Honor, to hit on some key points from the plaintiff's response to the court's questions. And obviously, as Ms. Bell did, I'll be happy to entertain any questions that you might have at the end of my presentation. So I think the key, obviously, question here is your first question, where you ask whether reasonable minds might disagree about the inferences to be drawn from the record, and you ask why or why not. And we respectfully submit that the Coalition has not shown, in its response to this question, that Commerce's determination was unreasonable or unsupported by substantial evidence. We view the Coalition here as really quibbling with how Commerce has weighed the facts, but we believe that here the facts that have been presented do rise to the level of substantial evidence. And that obviously is the key question for the court. And I'll come to the two facts in a moment, but, you know, I do want to reiterate it is a totality of the circumstances question, and Commerce is looking at the entire record as we covered in our responses to Your Honor's question. And not one fact, it's not the other fact, it's both in combination. And that's important here. I think that there was some suggestion in the briefing at various points from Coalition that Commerce only based its determination on the packing terms, and that Commerce did not actually rely also on the question of the marking. I think it seems like that suggestion has fallen by the wayside, which, you know, I raise it because it's very important, but it does seem like we've moved beyond that to the Coalition recognizing that both facts are part of Commerce's determination. So with respect to these two facts, the first, packing terms, and the second, the marking, obviously, as Ms. Bell did, I will be cautious and avoid any BPI and respectfully refer the court to the briefing. But the question here for Commerce was to determine whether the transaction that Chandon raised in its October 18th, 2017 submission was properly classed as a home market transaction or as for export. I think that, well, the Coalition has pointed to other evidence in the record that it believes undercuts the point about the packing of the goods for this transaction, but that other evidence in the record was not part of Commerce's home market viability determination. Commerce was focused here on this particular transaction and made findings with respect to this transaction. And so it may be that other evidence in the record does or does not demonstrate that other transactions were for the home market or not for the home market. That wasn't before Commerce. It wasn't put before Commerce by the Coalition. The Coalition isn't really contesting the truth or the accuracy of the evidence that, with respect to both packing and also marking, the Coalition isn't really contesting the veracity of the materials that were attached first to Chandon's October 18th, 2017 submission as evidence in support of its allegations, or that were also placed in the record later as part of the verification process. That evidence stands unrebutted. Now, the question that really the Coalition is focused on is a question of argumentation. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But just to, before talking about this distinction between evidence and argumentation, I just touch on, with respect to stamping, I think the argument that the Coalition has raised is that if Chandon didn't know which specific country was the destination for the issue, then it's impossible for the Commerce to find that the goods were not for home market consumption, were for export. And that simply is not the case. The Commerce explained in the record, I believe, that doesn't need to be the case, or at the very least, it doesn't necessarily need to be. There's just no justification provided by the Coalition for that assumption that in every instance a respondent must know final destination in order to know or reasonably should have known that goods were for export. It's just not necessary. And we touch on that, I think, in our briefs. I just wanted to raise it here generally. Now, the question then becomes, I think, one of the Coalition's key points is that Chandon didn't raise some of these arguments or didn't raise the two facts on which Commerce ultimately based its determination. Chandon didn't raise those early in the investigation as support for their allegation. And it wasn't required to. As we note in our own responses to Your Honor's question, and we would submit here with respect to your question number one to the coalition, it's not necessary for an argument to be raised at the outset. It doesn't, in every instance, Commerce is attempting to develop a determination based on evidence that is retrospective here. I mean, they're looking back at the period of investigation and attempting to understand what Chandon knew or should have known about this transaction. And so it's that objective evidence from the relevant period that stands as the basis for whether or not substantial evidence does or does not exist. The question of when a party precisely argues for a point, I don't think is at all relevant to the court's determination of whether or not Commerce has reached a rational conclusion on substantial evidence here.
A substantial evidence question.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that is, in your response to question five, the government stated that to the extent Commerce did not address certain of Coalition's arguments, that is because the arguments do not detract from the substantial evidence on which Commerce based its determinations. Could you explain why Coalition's arguments do not detract?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely.
Please.
Oh, of course. I apologize if I interrupted. The Coalition has raised, and we do get into this at page 10 of our response to Your Honor's question, the Coalition really has raised, I think, four arguments against Commerce's determination. And let me note that Commerce is only required to address material issues. And so, as I'll get into in a moment, some of the evidence raised by the Coalition is really doesn't detract or support Commerce's determination, and it doesn't matter, it's not relevant to Commerce if the respondent raises an argument that Commerce finds unpersuasive, but then finds other evidence that is persuasive. So specifically, one of the points was that the initial quote was in United States dollars, sale completed in rupees. There's nothing to suggest that even if the initial sale had not been quoted in United States dollars, there's nothing to suggest, and the Coalition never argues, that a sale that is made in rupees can't be destined for export. That's just not an assertion that they've made. All they've said is that the fact that it was in dollars initially does not support Commerce's determination, or could not support Commerce's determination, but that's not what Commerce relied on. Second, with respect to the mill test, respect to mill test certificates, the Coalition's challenge has to do with how these or what markets employ these certificates. And again, that question. Let's assume that the Coalition is correct that these might be used in multiple markets. That doesn't detract from the two points of evidence that I've already discussed with respect to export stamping and product packaging. I'm sorry, export packaging and product stamping. So it's an irrelevant point. It doesn't undercut the evidence. It's just material that's out there. And I think if Coalition had shown that it undercut the evidence, and perhaps in that instance, depending on how Coalition formulated that, perhaps Commerce would have a duty to address it. They haven't done that. All they've shown is that Commerce should not rely on it, and Commerce didn't rely on it. And then the third point that the Coalition raised has to do with the Coalition, with Chandon's citation to certain financial statements outside the period of investigation. And with that same response with respect to that is that that wasn't the basis for Commerce's determination. Those financial statements could say anything, but there's no suggestion that they undercut the two pieces of evidence. And the Coalition never argued that they undercut the two pieces of evidence on which Commerce did rely. And then finally, and this goes, I think, to your question number nine, I believe, to the Coalition, and also, of course, your question to us, Let me make sure that's right for the record. Yes, so your question to Coalition Number 9 and Number 10 to us having to do with the state of Indian law, that's the final argument, really, that the Coalition raises. And in that, I understand my friend Ms. Bell's point that this wasn't discussed, but I don't understand why it would need to be, because the issue, and we've said this in our papers, is that the Coalition never raised any factual support for this argument about the deemed passports. And so it may be that Commerce found, with respect to a different respondent, a different product, a different investigation, a different time frame, what the requirements of Indian law might be. But that hasn't been raised here with any specificity by the Coalition, the petitioners. And so there's no reason for Commerce to engage with speculation by the petitioner. If there had been more specificity, perhaps then Commerce might have been required to respond. But that wasn't necessary. And in the absence of any specificity, the claim doesn't undercut the evidence. And that, Your Honor, I think is a long answer, but I think answers your question of why the Coalition's counterarguments don't undercut the substantial evidence on which Commerce relied. And so I apologize. I'm just happily responding to your question. It allows me to jump ahead a little bit in my outline, if you'll excuse me. The next point I'd like to make with respect to your question number two to the Coalition of whether or not Commerce needs to address all evidence on the record. And I think the parties agree that Commerce is not required to explicitly address every piece of evidence on the record. And that's the Nucor case, which Coalition itself cites. It does need to address material evidence. And I have explained, I think, why Commerce did that here. It addressed the evidence and it addressed the arguments, or at least it addressed the arguments that were material. And frankly, the issues raised by Coalition weren't material, and so it was necessary for the Commerce to address it. All right, and I think, Your Honor, I think with respect to your question number 3B to the Coalition, the question about post hoc rationalization, I got into this earlier, sort of agreeing. I think that the Coalition's point about post hoc arguments, at least in its earlier briefing, was that the product stamping is something that was only raised for the first time in litigation. And I've already talked earlier about how I perceive now that the Coalition is, at least to my view, conceding that Commerce relied on two facts. And so it's the post hoc argument, I think, suggested that Commerce had relied on one fact in an IDM, and now here in the litigation was also relying on the export stamping. I think that has fallen by the wayside. The reason why it's not a post hoc rationalization is because Commerce did address both facts in the IDM. And I think that at least in agreement as to what Commerce relied on here. And obviously Ms. Bell may correct me, but I think that's right. The other point I'd like to make is respect to your question number 6 about whether Commerce was required, or I suppose go to number 6 and number 7 about any information that might have been held by or available to MFC as a member of the Coalition here. I think we generally agree that the question here is what Chandon knew or should have known. That is the legal test. But I also think that it's fair to expect that if MFC had access to information, then it should have put it on the record. I have no reason to doubt MSC's assertions that it didn't. But that just highlights, I think, you know, that is a question that is outside the record. What that highlights, and again, I'm talking here about your questions number 6 and number 7 to the coalition, what that highlights is the lack of any evidence on the record that undercuts the determination on these two facts. And, you know, I'll point out that the Consolo case and others stand for the proposition that the fact that it might be possible to reach two different conclusions on the evidence doesn't mean that Congress's determination lacks substantial evidence. And again, the coalition simply has not undercut our evidence. And I think I'll just touch on your question number 8 to the coalition, and then I think I can quickly address your question number 10, having already dealt with number 9, I believe, the legal issue. So with respect to number 8, you ask about the challenge of balancing the burden of the interested party to create an adequate record with Congress's duty to diligently inquire. And I submit, Your Honor, that the balance is not all that challenging to strike when we understand that the burden to create the adequate record comes first. So it's not enough to put allegations in the record. It's necessary to enter allegations that are supported by evidence, record evidence. And that hasn't happened here. All that, most of what the coalition has done, and we've explained why the other evidence that they've pointed to is not dispositive, all they've done is challenged Shandon's assertions, but they haven't undercut the two central points. And so the burden comes first. And then if there's something missing, then I think we understand that there's an expectation set forth in STUP and INA, that Commerce will diligently inquire. But ultimately, there needs to be something to inquire about, and there's no need here. I mean, there were questions placed to Shandon, and Shandon provided information, and it obviously affirmatively made allegations about these sales and their export status, and there was nothing further to seek because the evidence stands unrebutted. And finally, I think with respect to the relevance of Shandon's representation, well, the parties agree that Shandon's obligations are unaffected by whether or not they've chosen to retain counsel. They're free to, and they're free not to. And in either event, they need to meet the statutory and regulatory requirements that are placed upon them as respondents in the anti-dumping investigation. I will just say quickly that it seems to me that Ms. Bell's statements about sort of Shandon's behavior in the course of the investigation as an unrepresented party goes back to my earlier point about understanding the distinction between the evidence and how allegations are presented or arguments are presented in the course of the investigation. The evidence says what it says. The material attached to that October 18th letter says what it says. And that Shandon was able to articulate arguments without the assistance of counsel, more power to it, I suppose, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't show anything one way or the other, and it's irrelevant to Congress's determination. And with that, I think I've dealt with everything I had to say in response to plaintiff's answers to your questions, Your Honor. I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
Mr. Long, thank you for your fine presentation. I have one other question, and that's in the government's response in opposition to plaintiff's motion for judgment on the agency record, dated September 10th, 2019, the government defendant argued that, quote, it is reasonable to infer that a price initially quoted in U.S. dollars was intended for export even where the sale was ultimately consummated in rupees, end quote. Why was this a reasonable inference for Commerce to make?
Well, Your Honor, I suppose that that statement is not as well articulated as it should be. Just thinking about it and going back to what I think I've said here earlier in this hearing, that inference, whether or not it's reasonable, is not the basis for Commerce's determination. I think a better articulation, which hopefully I can clean up even more now, because what I said earlier, is that the fact that a sale was in rupees, period, irrespective of initial quotes, the fact that a sale is in rupees, which is undisputed here, doesn't mean that it could not be destined for export or not for home market consumption. And so the initial quote in U.S. dollars is not what Commerce based its determination on. And so, as I said a second ago, perhaps it's reasonable, perhaps it's not. But I don't think that that sentence that I've placed there, and this is obviously on me, I don't think that that sentence gets to the point that I'm trying to make here, which is that the sale in rupees does not mean that it was not for export. And I don't think that the coalition, as I said earlier, I don't think the coalition is arguing that, you know, the fact that a sale is in rupees necessarily means that it was not for export. Does that make sense, Your Honor? I apologize if my briefing isn't clear.
Well, thank you for your answer. And I was quoting from page 9.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, I'm right there looking at it. I'm right there looking at it. Yes.
Thank you. Do you wish to say anything more, Mr. Wong?
No, Your Honor. That's all I have.
I'd like to thank counsel for your enlightening arguments. And I will give counsel until close of business Tuesday, April 14th, that is until 5 p.m., April 14th, the opportunity to make a supplemental submission of not more than 3 single-space pages in response to the oral argument this morning. And you have no obligation to do so. It's simply an opportunity by way of follow-up for lawyers for both sides to make such a submission. I'd like to thank Ms. Bell, Mr. Pickard, Mr. Long, Ms. Huff, for your participation this morning. And we all look forward to seeing you in the courthouse in New York. Until then, be safe, be well, and we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We're sorry. Your conference is ending now. Please hang